This evening I'd like to look at a set of documents that we have gone through, basically the canon of the Bible. We looked at why those particular documents ended up in our Old Testament, why they ended up in the New Testament. Been going through a number of these things over the last 6 months or so. Just every once in a while bringing these topics out. I didn't want to do it all at once because sometimes it can be a little bit dry. So I'm trying to avoid that. But I do think it's an important thing that we need to focus on and look at, because every once in a while you'll run into people saying, well, why don't we have some other document in our Bibles? You know, the book of Enoch or the Gospel of Judas not long ago was popular. You know, every once in a while one of these documents comes popping up and people are asking, well, why don't we have that in our Bible? First off, though, we need to understand why these other documents exist. Jude, in fact, I'm going to deviate right now. Jude verse 3, before I even get into the lesson. Jude verse 3 says, "Beloved, while I was making every effort to write to you about our common salvation, I felt the necessity to write to you appealing that you contend earnestly for the faith, which was once for all handed down to the saints." Jude very clearly states the gospel message was delivered at one time period. And yet we find documents continuing to be generated over time. And the question is, why aren't these allowed? Why aren't they there? Most of the reasons why these things are being promoted is to propagate some type of doctrine, usually a false doctrine, well, obviously it would be a false doctrine, because it cannot be supported by what is actually in the Scriptures. Now, one of the places where it becomes a ripe breeding ground for these things is they look for the places in the Scriptures where the Bible doesn't say anything. Well, if it doesn't say anything, then you can speculate anything you want. You can fill it in with anything you want. You know, have you ever wondered what Jesus' childhood was like? So have many others, and that's led to a set of documents, and we're going to look at these, that are called the infancy gospels. People have written what they imagine his childhood would be like. You know, for instance, what happened to Joseph? You know, we see him when Christ is born, but he kind of disappears. You know, what happened to Mary after Jesus' death? What happened to the other apostles? Depending on how it's read, some suppose, for instance, that Paul wrote 3 letters to the Corinthians. I think it was a misunderstanding of that passage, but you know, somebody said, oh, 3 letters, we got 2. And somebody writes the 3rd one to fill in the gap, to add in whatever doctrine they want. So we're going to take a look at these and see why they are rejected. Because, like I said, every once in a while it comes up, well, why don't we have those? Usually with an atheist. But you'll find it also with some other groups as well. The first one we're going to look at is called the, and I'm going to try to take these in time order. There's one called the Infancy Gospel of James. It was written and speculated about 145 A.D., it's first mentioned by Origen of Alexandria in the 3rd century, who said it was a recent work of dubious character. So early Christians by the 3rd century were already saying, I'm not so certain about this one, and it looks like recent work. In fact, here's what Origen said about it. It says, "But some say, basing it on a tradition in the Gospel according to Peter, as is entitled, or the book of James, that the brethren of Jesus were sons of Mary by a former wife, whom he had married before Mary. Now those who say so wish to preserve the honor of Mary in virginity to the end, so that the body of hers which was appointed to the ministry, to minister to the word, which said, the Holy Ghost shall come upon thee, and the power of the Most High shall overshadow thee, might not know intercourse with a man after that the Holy Spirit came into her, and the power on high overshadowed her. I think it in harmony with reason that Jesus was the first fruit among men, of the purity that consists of the chastity and Mary among women. For were it not pious to ascribe to any other than to her the first fruits of virginity? So Origen basically says, okay, there's a bunch of people running around now saying it's just too horrible to suppose that Mary had other children after Jesus. Because that's just not right. And so this document, he said, was one of the ones that were written trying to come up with this idea that Mary was a perpetual virgin. It claims to be written by James from Jerusalem. But it can't be the Apostle James, because he died in Acts 12. That was around about AD 42. Yet the infancy gospel of James clearly borrows and elaborates on Matthew and Mark's accounts. Well, Luke's account is probably written about AD 62, somewhere in that range. And if it's borrowing from that, it can't be written by the Apostle James because he died 20 years before that. Perhaps it was James, the Lord's brother, but secular history puts his death at AD 62. So it'd be kind of hard for him to be borrowing Luke's work while dying about the same time. It'd be difficult to get the coordination down right. Be just a little bit too early. So while it claims to be from James, we don't know which James. It just says James from Jerusalem. It really doesn't say which one. And it may not have been a James at all. We don't know who actually wrote it. It contains three parts. It has a section that talks about the birth of Mary, Joachim, and Anna in her old age. They pick Anna, and her childhood and dedication to the temple. And they pick Anna because Anna is mentioned as being at the temple later. Joachim is mentioned in the scriptures as being Mary's father. Starting at age 12 for Mary, how an angel uses lots to select Joseph to be her husband. Why age 12? Well, Jesus appears in the temple at age 12. They're borrowing things from the scriptures right and left. There's the nativity of Jesus, the visit of the midwives, the hiding of Jesus from Herod the Great. But they also then add in that John the Baptist is hidden from the slaughter of the infants in this particular account. So hiding him from Herod Antipas. It presents Mary as a perpetual virgin, as we said. And it's to cover that, then they say that Joseph was a widower who had children from a prior marriage. But if you start thinking about it, that presents a lot of other problems. If Joseph is a widower, and it's through Joseph that the lineage of the kings comes, this is the reason why Jesus has rights to the throne of David, because he's the son of Joseph. If Jesus is not the firstborn, then he could not inherit the throne of David through Joseph. And how could then the other children of Joseph be the Lord's brothers and sisters if they both had different fathers and different mothers? Have you thought of that also? See, if Joseph had children by another, then the mother and the father are different from Jesus. So how could they be brothers and sisters? It makes it difficult. So while trying to explain away something that they don't want to face, they add additional difficulties and problems while they're going through, by dealing with this. This is not the only problems that we find in this particular one. Some additional problems here are, for instance, Joachim's. When you first run across him, Joachim's offering is rejected because he had no children. Now, whoever wrote this really doesn't know the Jewish religion. Because if you go through your Old Testament, where does it say that you can't offer offerings to God if you don't have kids yet? But they wanted to get, create a problem. Anna and her maid Judith know it's the time for Jesus coming, as if it were common knowledge. They're discussing it before Mary is even a grown-up child. They're discussing both time, you know, about the time before the Messiah showed up. The Jews had no clues when exactly the Messiah was going to show up. They were always looking for the Messiah, but they didn't know when. What you find instead is it borrows things like similar situation from the birth of John. We got an elderly, childless couple, only now we apply it to Mary's parents. It borrows from the birth of Samuel, where there's a prayer for a child and a dedication of the child to God, because they have Mary being dedicated at the temple permanently as a small child. It also has a bunch of Gnostic ideas. For instance, Mary's not allowed to walk on the earth. Her mother, Anna, finds her walking on the earth. And, this can't be. So she's locked up in her bedroom. And it's a Gnostic idea because anything dealing with the earth is bad stuff. The bad God created the earth. So you don't want somebody who's supposed to be pure contacting the earth. I can't imagine somebody really raising a child never getting out of bed or out of her bedroom. The infancy gospel has both Joseph and Mary. Remember, Joseph is upset that Mary might have committed adultery. Well, they have him going to a priest and taking that trial to discover whether somebody is an adulteress or not. And in Numbers, there is a trial that's used when a wife is accused by her husband. But the thing is, though, they're not married yet. They're engaged. The other problem is that the trial in Numbers is only the woman takes the bitter waters. In this gospel, both Joseph and Mary take the bitter waters. So again, the conclusion by most people that look at it is that whoever wrote this is not Jewish. They get all sorts of little details about the old law wrong. It also conflicts with Matthew's statement, because Matthew states very clearly that Joseph wanted to put Mary away quietly. He wanted to end the engagement on a very quiet note, because he loved her. Well, if you want to end it on a quiet note, you don't go to the priest and have a trial of adultery, which is a very public thing. So it becomes a conflict with the current Gospels. It also has Herod searching for John. When he couldn't kill Jesus after he was born, he starts searching for John to kill him. And I scratched my head and I said, now how does he know who John is? Now Jesus is announced. And we have the wise men coming to talk about Jesus. But who pre-announced John's birth? So the Herod knows who he's looking for. And what this book has is Zacharias' murder. While trying to protect John, Elizabeth and John run off to the south into the desert, and Zacharias stays at the temple and puts up a front, and he gets killed for it. Now, the reason why they have that in there is to cover one of the things that Jesus says about Zacharias, all the prophets who were died from Abel to Zacharias, and say, okay, that's the Zacharias who's killed in the temple. We covered that particular passage. But one of the problems also with this, when it says Herod's looking for John, we know from the scriptures that Herod was killing children in the Bethlehem area. John grew up in South Judea, not near Bethlehem. Somebody doesn't know the geography. Either that they moved John from the south into Bethlehem to cover having him in the same situation with Jesus. Another weird thing, when I was reading through it, one of the places that was really strange is it has Joseph, who's in the middle of Judea, Jewish country, right? Making sure that he gets a Hebrew midwife for his Mary so that she can deliver. Well, I would expect in Judea, most of the midwives would probably be, it'd be hard to find one that's not Hebrew. But it has it happen. I suspect they were remembering a piece out of the out of Exodus where it talks about the Hebrew midwives. And so that's why it was stuck in there. Another thing also we find is that it borrows characters from the Gospels, reassigns them roles like Anna. Salome is borrowed as Mary's midwife. All the names are unqualified. If you actually look in real documents, if you go through the books of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, when you find somebody with a common name, they're almost always presented with a qualifier. So, for instance, if there's Simon, you don't just see Simon, you see Simon the Tanner, Simon the Leper. Why? Because Simon was the most popular name in that region at the time. And so you got to qualify so that everybody knows which Simon you're talking about. But when we go through some of these infancy gospels, they don't bother with the qualifiers. Whether the name's popular or unpopular, they just present names. Another thing you also find is if you go through the gospels, you find all sorts of rich little details. Like people going up to Jerusalem. Or up from Nazareth to or down from Nazareth to Capernaum. Mentioning little villages. Mentioning little tidbits and little facts. You don't find that in the infancy gospels. In fact, for instance, in this infancy gospel, there's only Judea, Jerusalem, and Bethlehem. There are all only places mentioned in that entire gospel. Bethlehem is the only small town, but it's a famous town because that's where Jesus was born. Jerusalem is the big city. Of course it's mentioned. Judea is a region. Of course that's mentioned. But what about all the other little villages? It doesn't mention anything else. So it has no characteristics of being written by an eyewitness person. This, by the way, if you haven't figured it out, this is where the Roman Catholics get much of their mysticism regarding Mary. But what's fascinating, this is a book also the Catholic Church rejects. It says this is a fraud, officially. In fact, in the Catholic Encyclopedia, it says in their own writings, states that the infancy gospel of James is based on the canonical gospels, which it expands with legendary and imaginative elements, some of which are puerile and fantastic. It's completely imaginary and just too big to swallow. This book was also condemned by the Western Church by Pope Damascus, Innocent, and another guy, his name I can't pronounce. But person after person after person says this is a false gospel. But this is also where they get all their ideas about Mary being a perpetual virgin and other things that pop up in the Roman Catholic religion. Now another one, and I'll go a little bit faster. I wanted to spend a little bit of time with this one because what ends up happening is each of them start borrowing from the previous one. There's another one that's called the Infancy Gospel of Thomas. It's also about the mid-second century. It was first mentioned by Irenaeus about 185 as a part of a list of unreliable, unacceptable writings. It borrows from Luke's account of Jesus in the temple. The only problem we have with this one is while we have it, all the manuscripts that we have are all old, relatively. They're 13th century. We don't have any manuscripts that are close to when it was supposedly written. We know where it was written because it was mentioned, but we don't have documents that go back that far for it. So in other words, some of these things we're talking about, I can't rule out somebody forging things or changing things over the years. As far as its content, it relates the miracles, the purported miracles of Jesus before the age of 12. The problem is we have several documents of them. They're all different. They don't all read the same. The miracles listed are not quite all the same. So there's large variations. But the problem is that Jesus is described as being a trickster. He's infinitely wise, yet he's also very cruel. Imagine Jesus as being like a typical small child with too much power and not enough smarts. For instance, in this one, Jesus kills one child because he scattered his water. He kills another because he bumps him. Or another version says he threw a stone at him, depending on the version. But another child gets him annoyed and he kills him too. He then blinds the neighbor who complains about their child being killed. And then he scolds Joseph for punishing him for his mischief. And I'm thinking, these people think this is what Jesus was like when he was a child? Of course, there's lots of problems with it. For instance, John says in John chapter 2 that Jesus' first miracle was at Cana, at the wedding. If that's when Jesus did his first miracle, then how could he do miracles when he was a child? He also, this gospel also has Jesus doing miracles in Nazareth, which contradicts what Luke said in Luke 4, where it's mentioned that they thought Jesus was only the carpenter's son. They didn't think of him as anything special. Yet he supposedly grew up doing all these mischievous, miraculous things. It has Jesus acting out of revenge, contrary to what's described in Luke chapter 12, verse 17 and all, where you do not take personal revenge. It basically has Jesus as a child violating the law. There's also numerous little mistakes about Jewish life and Jewish customs, showing the author does not understand Judaism of that time period. As we mentioned before, it's rejected by several early Christian writers, Irenaeus, Hypatalist, and Origen all said is false. I can't say the word today. Again, as far as the names go, the only qualified name is Thomas, and it says Thomas the Israelite, which is a horrible qualifier. If you're trying to distinguish between different Thomases, you don't say, well, it'd be like saying Thomas the Jew. Okay, we got five Thomases that are Jews. Which one are you talking about? That doesn't help in qualifying it. The only non-biblical name in there is Zeno. Most of the characters are unnamed. The only place name mentioned is Jerusalem, and it's picked up from Luke chapter 2 when it's copying it. Otherwise, it doesn't mention place names. Again, doesn't read like somebody with an eyewitness account. It just doesn't read like Matthew or Luke, of somebody who actually was there and remembers details. Okay, so we got two infancy gospels, one that adds miracles, one that tries to explain Mary and throws Mary into it. So then there's another one that comes along called The Life of John the Baptist. This one we're now into the somewhere around 385 to 390. What's interesting about this one, we know who wrote it. We're pretty sure that a man named Serapion is the writer. He's a Catholic bishop of Thymus. In that document, it mentions Pope Theophilus, who died in AD 412. So that's how we know the dating of this particular document. What it does is it retells Luke and Matthew's accounts and then borrows very heavily from the infancy gospel of James to fill in the gaps. So it blends all these together. Again, some of the problems that come up with it, it moves John's home from southern Judea to Bethlehem to solve the problem of the killing of the infants. It has Elizabeth fleeing with John and Zachary staying behind to be a martyr. We already talked about that. Still doesn't explain how Herod's aware of John. And by the way, the statement that is the reason why this is being done is the statement is in Matthew chapter 23. You want to take a look at that. Matthew 23 and verse 35. Jesus says, so that upon you may fall the guilt of all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Micaiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. And there is a Zacharias in the Old Testament who is murdered in that spot, but he has a different father's name. And so they said, okay, there must be Zacharias who's John's father. And so they assume that this Berechias is his father's name and adds it on there. Again, it has the killing of the infants not being in a small region, but widespread across all of Judea. Has some anachronisms. Those are when you place things out of date or time. Things that should not have happened, and they put it there. Like, for instance, it mentions that there was a lack of monasteries with monks in the wilderness where Elizabeth runs off to. Catholics have monks in monasteries. Not the Jews. When Elizabeth dies, before she's buried, it mentions that the sign of the cross is done over her three times. Wait a minute. They didn't do the sign of the cross back then. Jesus hadn't even died on the cross yet. You have to have somebody doing a sign of a cross over somebody who died. Now, little mistakes like that, that appears in the book. It gets the names of Herod's children. Herod the Great gets the names all wrong, gets them mixed up. That, by the way, I don't blame them. If you ever want to get a mixed up family, try doing the family tree of Herod the Great. I mean, it is mind-boggling complex. Because they intermarried within each other and named their children similar names. I mean, it's not hard to get it wrong. But this document gets it wrong. It has Herodias married to Herod the Younger instead of Herod Antipas, who is said to have had a stroke when John's head flies away. When John's beheaded, the ceiling breaks, the head flies up through the ceiling. By the way, the head flies around for 3 years above Jerusalem, announcing that Herod had no right to marry Herodias. You would think somebody else would notice a flying head for 3 years. But it flies around for 3 years, and then then it gets quiet for 12 more years, and then after 15 years, it flies off to someplace to get buried. Herodias, by the way, supposedly dies by the earth swallowing her up to the neck. The only problem is Josephus, who's a historian, tells us Herodias died in exile with her husband Herod Antipas. They got exiled and she died in exile. But this book says, you know, when John was killed, the earth swallowed her up to her neck and she died. It has the name of Herodias' daughter wrong, because Josephus records that her daughter's name was Salome. It's not in the scriptures. But Josephus tells us Herodias' daughter's name is Salome. Well, this one has it as Exariana is what name they give it to her. And she dies because she goes out after she gives John's head off. She goes out on the frozen lake and is skating around, and then the ice cracks and she falls in up to her neck and gets, and they can't get her out, so they decide to cut her head off. That one I get puzzled over too. You know, why not cut the ice if she's stuck in the ice? But anyway, by the way, history tells us that Salome had married another of Herod's descendants, who is also named Philip, and so she marries off to an uncle. And no, she did not die in an icy lake. So it gets lots of the details wrong. It doesn't match history. Then we got an infancy gospel of Matthew. Actually, all this is a composite of the Gospel of James and the Gospel of Thomas. Put those two together, and it becomes the Gospel of Matthew. Or sometimes it's called the book about the origin of the Blessed Mary and the childhood of the Savior. It was very, very popular during the Middle Ages. A lot of people loved to read it. Its dating is about 600 to 625. It sometimes is dated as late as the 8th century or the 9th century. It starts out with a series of letters between Jerome and the bishops of Cantanius and Helodorus, where they send a request that Jerome translate a work of Matthew concerning Mary's birth and Jesus' childhood. The big problem we have with those letters that are in this document is the letters purport to be from Jerome, but they're not written in his style of writing. The letters indicate basically a very late writing of this document. It's supposedly translated from Hebrew, but we know that the Gospel of Matthew was written in Greek. It contains the infancy Gospel of James, followed by an account of the flight into Egypt, and ends with the infancy Gospel of Thomas. So basically, we add in yet another account, another gap. What was it like to run into Egypt and live down there? So they add some more things into it. Then we get a Syriac infancy gospel. Now we're up to about the 5th or 6th century. It's based on the infancy gospel of Matthew, which is a composite. Here it adds in that Jesus speaks as an infant from the cradle. The reason why it's of interest is because Syriac, which is up near Arabia, and the Quran has Jesus speaking from the cradle. The only difference is, of course, the Quran has different words, because the words they have in this gospel says that he's the Son of God, and of course, Islam does not believe that Jesus is the Son of God, so they change the wording of it. But it's probably from this gospel where Muhammad got his material and the idea from it. If you ever want to look in the Quran, it's Surah 19, verses 29 to 34. But you can find it's very similar to this one, just different words. Then the last one we're going to look at is the history of Joseph the carpenter. That's believed to be written about the 6th or 7th century. It's written in Greek, but the only surviving copies we have are an Arabic translation and a Coptic translation. And it's just basically a retelling of the infancy gospel of James. So I've gone through all these. The question is, why do we care? Well, these are the documents, at least several of them, where Roman Catholic beliefs come from. You always wondered why they make such a big deal out of Mary. Well, a lot of it comes from these documents. They basically argue, even though they reject these individual documents, they basically say, well, there must have been something there to inspire all these documents to say these things, instead of going to the logical conclusion one is borrowing from the other one and building off of each other's tale. So the idea that Mary was a perpetual virgin is traced back to the infancy gospel of James. The idea that Joseph was a widower and that the other siblings of Jesus were from the first marriage also comes from that same document. The miracles of Jesus' childhood, that goes back to the infancy gospel of Thomas. And what we see is story being built up by one author, being elaborated by another author who's elaborating on that one, changing some of the details, moving things around. And even though they're recognized to be false works, still the myths introduced become a part of the Catholic tradition. Take a look at 2 Timothy chapter 4. 2 Timothy chapter 4. And starting with verse 3. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but wanting to have their ears tickled, they will accumulate for themselves teachers in accordance to their own desires, and will turn away their ears from the truth, and will turn aside to myths. What Paul said is true. People wanted other things. And they were willing to create myths to justify their beliefs. And even when they know it's wrong, they prefer the myth. You know, when God is silent, people have a strong tendency to fill in the gap with their own imagination. And we don't want to fall into that trap. Now, even if you never read the Infancy Gospel of Thomas or any of those other ones, the reason we want to understand this is we want to know that the motivation behind it. The Bible is not an evolving fairy tale, as some people wish to claim. It was delivered by God, is consistent, it is done, is complete, it is able to make us perfect. And we don't need any additional documents. Those who want to justify other things seek out other documents. Hope you at least think about these things. Hope this was at least a little bit of use to you. If there's anyone here tonight, though we didn't talk about that, who wishes to become a child of God, there is no better time than right now to put on Christ. If there's anyone here who is a child of God, would like to pray as their brethren on behalf, why don't you come forward as we sing the song that's selected.